Hello, and welcome to episode 4 of the global edition of Awin Talks, the affiliate marketing podcast. I'm your host, Rob Davidson, and I'm joined today by my colleagues, Kevin Edwards.
Hello.
And Craig Foster.
Hello.
From our strategy and business intelligence teams, respectively. Now, this month, continuing the theme from our previous episode, we'll be interviewing another external guest in the form of Gary Keibel, an expert on digital media legislation from the US-based legal firm Davis & Gilbert. With lawmakers around the world attempting to get to grips with the fast-changing nature of online advertising and its impact upon digital citizens, Gary's interview with Kevin a little later in this edition of Awin Talks will help to shed some light on what he sees as being the likely outcome from many of these new legislative initiatives, and particularly those that are affecting the US market directly. So stay tuned for that interview a little later in today's episode. Before that, though, Kevin, Craig, and I have been casting our eye over some of the major digital industry news and events that have been taking place in recent weeks.
So as we've previously covered off, I think a couple of months ago when Rob, you were talking to Ed Chaput from Awin, we were talking about, in that instance, ITP, Intelligent Tracking Prevention, which is specifically related to the Safari browser. And so I suppose that the big news from that perspective is that the new version was, the version 2.0 was rolled out on Monday this week. And the headline for everyone is that it fundamentally changes the handling of third-party cookies. You know, we were aware of this, and so we've been putting in place various different systems and processes to try and mitigate any damage to our tracking. So just to recap, the previous iteration of ITP gave a 24-hour window for third-party cookies, but this window has now been removed and all third-party cookies on Safari have been blocked, which in turn potentially nullifies many affiliate links, ad tech tools, third-party tracking, etc. So I suppose it's natural that this has caused uncertainty and concern, especially within the affiliate and performance marketing industry, with Apple's senior VP of software engineering actually saying that it will be dramatically more difficult for data companies to identify and track consumers. That obviously pushes out a worrying message to everybody working in the space. So from an affiliate perspective, where are we? There's probably a couple of points here that's important to consider. Firstly, ITP crystallizes the importance of fit-for-purpose tracking. So many networks and third parties have issued guidance and information over the past few weeks about their current tracking capabilities. And what we're seeing is an opportunity really for all of us to push our first-party tracking solutions. It kind of gives us the momentum we need to retire legacy systems. I think what's vitally important is that in this transitional period, networks and affiliates apply joint pressure to brands who, some of whom are dragging their heels about reintegration. Incidentally, if anyone listening wants to find out more about it, then we will be, by the time this is broadcast, hopefully our new white paper on ITP and the broader issues around it will have been released. But you can also find out more information on our blog and our wiki page as well. So the second point I wanted to briefly make, which is part of a much, much bigger issue, is that ITP isn't an affiliate-specific issue. It's certainly not singling out our channel for harm. But what we're seeing more generally is probably a clampdown on data sharing, focus on privacy, and a general growing awareness that digital marketing has to make fundamental changes if it's to survive. So we've talked in the past about any given year potentially representing a watershed, you know, crossroads moment, whether it's mobile or cross-device tracking. But really, this feels part of much greater macro forces at work that may be ushering in a new wave of digital marketing. So this was something that both Rob and I explored at DMexico this month, where we considered the kind of seemingly existential crisis that digital marketing is facing. See, it very much feels like it's under attack from all sides, whether it's ad blocking, GDPR, other regulatory legislation, ITP, demands for greater transparency, and so on. I think the point here is that these are challenges that scoop everybody up, us included. They don't discriminate, even though we know most of these initiatives actually probably have programmatic and display in their crosshairs. But anyway, with all of these things, we have to obviously see the opportunity and the upside. And I think that we can all agree that affiliate marketing can carve out a really compelling narrative about how it's data light, offers a simple transactional and transparent model, as well as an obvious value exchange between affiliates and consumers. So I think for now, we're very much at the foothills of this discussion at the moment, but I would certainly expect this to be a topic that we return to in the near future.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, and on that as well, I suppose as a network, we will be releasing some numbers on, you know, the impact of ITP. At some point, we've obviously, with it going live this week, we're starting to analyze the impact based on, you know, last week and previous date periods as well. At the moment, I'm running some numbers at the moment around, you know, isolating basic sales from particular devices like Apple devices, and also looking at, cookie-based sales as well to try and bring in some possible figures around what the impact could be. Obviously, eventually we'll be looking at actual browsers and how many people are kind of upgrading to the latest version of Safari, which will give us a much bigger insight into the kind of impact. So far, all I can say is, I suppose, the impact is different per territory. And so, yeah, as I say, we'll be releasing more figures around that at some point in the near future.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly something we're obviously pushing out. You know, we've initially focused in on our major clients across the network. Mm. In a sense, it's a little bit frustrating because with everyone that you do manage to switch over to kind of first party fit for purpose tracking, you're doing that at the same time as mobile growing exponentially every month anyway. So yeah, some of that is definitely being offset, mm-hmm. Kind of taking away some of that, some of those positive results we're seeing. But it's a huge project. It's a huge project for everybody, really. And as I say, we're trying to be as transparent as possible. Mm-hmm. And this isn't a one-off. This is very much the direction of travel. So it's something that we're all... it's kind of the new age, if you like, of tracking that we're all going to have to embrace and have solutions for.
Yeah, and there is a, you know, as you said before, there is a part to play for publishers here, really, in, you know, having those conversations with clients themselves around, you know, what tracking they have available currently, what their, you know, and the preferred solution, I suppose. So we'll see how that goes anyway.
I think transparency is a term that kind of cropped up a couple of times in what you were just talking about, Kev, and it's something that I've seen mentioned in various commentary around some of the issues that are assailing the digital ad industry at the moment, and whether that's from a consumer perspective, so this transparency around how these tech platforms work, how their data is being used, kind of making that kind of information available to them so that they understand exactly how they're accessing content and what they're getting in exchange for that, or what's being exchanged as part of that process. There's also transparency from advertiser and publisher perspectives as well. So around the whole kind of monetization of publisher sites, how they're actually kind of successfully being made aware of what's happening on their site in terms of the ads that are being served there. And from advertisers, I mean, we've seen kind of like since the start of last year and Mark Pritchard's speech talking about the ad industry being opaque at best and murky at
worst.
Worst, or murky at best and fraudulent at worst, I think.
Something like that.
It gets progressively worse. Yeah.
It gets worse, as you said, the sentence. Yeah.
So, and that's actually something that caught my attention this month in terms of kind of latest news as well. Transparency was key to that because we saw news that a man in Italy has been arrested, charged, fined, and imprisoned. He wasn't beaten. It was just imprisoned over false reviews that he actually supplied on TripAdvisor. Now, this currently unnamed individual was the owner of a business called Promo Salento, and he was convicted to 9 months in prison, as well as suffering an €8,000 fine for selling fake reviews to hundreds of hospitality businesses across Italy in order to raise their profile on the travel review site. Now, this is something that's a bit of a landmark ruling for internet cases. It's thought to be the first time someone has actually been given a custodial sentence for selling fraudulent reviews online. And interestingly, TripAdvisor were fully behind the prosecution of this case, with their associate general counsel, a guy called Brad Young, stating in the aftermath of the ruling that TripAdvisor has been proactively trying to prevent underhand tactics like this, but it could only do so much alone, which is why it was eager to collaborate with regulators. Now, interestingly, that actually coincides, the timing of this ruling actually coincided with some similar news that we heard from Amazon, where a recent Wall Street Journal investigation found that some sellers on the marketplace had been bribing Amazon employees to remove bad customer reviews of their products. This was, practice was cited as being particularly evident in China, where the chat platform WeChat was being used to broker deals between sellers and Amazon employees, who were then being paid up to $300 for each review that was deleted. So in both of these instances, on Amazon and TripAdvisor, we can see these huge kind of platforms that have previously been used as a means of brands or businesses trying to kind of promote themselves to an audience, a huge audience as well, but that certain individuals are using underhand tactics to kind of game that platform and game their presence on those platforms as well.
It makes you wonder what the general standards are around it, because a lot of this stuff is surely only short-termist. You can't really expect to get away from it, get away with it for long. I think that with, you know, we've talked about influencers a lot, and it's kind of a massive buzzword in the industry at the moment. And there has been a lot recently about influencers buying followers as well. And in a sense, it's sort of a similar issue to this, but you kind of would expect that more with influencers. It's kind of seen as a more, like a newer, ripe to be abused, I suppose, as a newer platform that's out there. But it kind of all lends itself back to this whole sort of topic of authenticity, really, and authenticity of voice. And realistically, this stuff is going to be caught, and you wouldn't expect it to be.
It's not a long term thing, is it?
No.
I mean, I'd like to think that, again, I mean, obviously we're hardly impartial, but this is an affiliate marketing podcast. But I do think that it potentially paints that distribution of promotional methods and partners in an affiliate marketing program, generally speaking, it paints that in a good light, because you're not obviously investing your budget into one platform or into one format. You're not putting all of your eggs into one proverbial basket. And by kind of diffusing your marketing budget or commitment across various different affiliate partners, when something like that happens and it affects one of your partners, then obviously you're able to kind of balance it out across all of the others that you kind of work with. And so there's an ecosystem that's going on there that kind of organically balances the way that you're looking to get your marketing messages out online.
Yeah, I mean, you are going to see, I think this is going to move towards more around the disclosure argument, isn't it? Around, you know, having some kind of seal of approval where it would be, you know, where you would know that something is sponsored or paid for, have to do that kind of thing. And I think that's where we'll come in terms of affiliates, and affiliate channel will be affected. Obviously, there is the sponsored content side of things anyway. So you have to kind of showcase that something's sponsored content. But, you know, affiliates, there is a commercial relationship where you have bloggers and reviewers and stuff where they are making money off something that they are reviewing. And so there has to be that kind of disclosure to the user if that is the case. I mean, sometimes it's obvious, the user should kind of know, but then you kind of have to explain it more.
I think that even with some of these controversies, it's not necessarily preventing advertisers from investing their budgets in online as a general kind of format. And I know that is something that you've been having a look at with the recent report that you were reading, Craig.
Yeah. So I suppose the my kind of segment of this would be around the recent report around worldwide ad spending, breaks it down by country. I figured I'd give you a little bit of a quiz as well, both of you, just to see.
Love quizzes.
Yeah, just to see how knowledgeable you really are. So in terms of total media ad spending, which is the biggest country? Quite an obvious one, I think.
Definitely Angola, isn't
it? That insults more countries, Rob.
US.
Yes, that is correct.
It's us.
What is, so the nearest 100 billion, what do you reckon that is?
What, the total worldwide ad spend?
Yeah, total ad US. Spend in the US, yeah.
Oh, in the US. I think it's your turn, Kev.
Yeah, it's for you, Kev, that one.
$380.
No, it was like $223.
That's all right. Well, that will be what it will be in a few years' time.
Yeah. Okay. So, what you might get this one quite easily as well. What's the biggest grower then?
Out of the whole world.
Yes.
China.
Yeah. There you go.
Yes,
that is correct, Rob.
Easy.
Generally knows more than Kev, I think.
It's like we rehearsed this.
Yeah. No. Okay. So there's all right then. So digital ad spend, and then we're going to digital. Okay.
Can't wait.
Again, US being the biggest. Mm-hmm. They actually spend about half of all ad spend on digital. So it's about $111 billion mm-hmm. on digital. Then where do you think UK comes in all of that then?
In terms of, come on,
the Craig. Highest. So in terms of a country, it's in terms of its economy, what, sixth in the world? Where do you think it comes in the digital ad spend?
Per capita or overall?
It's not just overall.
Overall.
Overall's fourth.
Third, actually. Again. Mm. Kev wrong. Okay. So, yeah.
Craig is enjoying this.
Yeah, I'm enjoying it.
I'm not.
Okay. All right. So, yeah. The other point, I'm not going to ask you any more questions because
you're not a regular quiz master.
I'm not a regular quiz master. No. There's other points as well. So, the fact in terms of growth, China is also the biggest in terms of digital ad spend growth. It is actually now bigger than the UK. So, in terms of what they refer to as the ad spend penetration, in terms of how much you spend in digital compared to the whole against the whole of your total media ad spend, okay, China is actually 64% of all of its is of all of its spend is on digital, and the UK is the second highest in the world. So it used to be the highest, the UK, and that's at 63%. Other large ones are Norway, which is 56%, and the US, as I said, was just under half of its spend.
Australia's pretty high, isn't it?
And Australia is high, yeah, that's like 55%.
I think Australia has the highest, it's either per capita online spend, as in retail, or
it did last year.
Ad spend. It's, and yeah. In the UK is second.
Yeah, I was trying to find some information on the per capita stuff, because that is quite interesting. But yeah, there is some more detailed things available from last year, but to get the updated stuff, it's clearly not been released yet.
I'd be intrigued to know whether or not China's mobile ad spend is.
It's on here. I'll find that out for you.
But it's fine.
Yeah, I would imagine that it's.
That's not even actually reported. One thing they do have on here is actual forecasts, which are quite interesting. So if you look on digital, let's say the digital ad spending forecast, let me just get that up. So the likes of China by 2022 are going to be spending $112 billion. On digital, where at the moment, as I said, it was around 62 billion. So, what other ones were there?
I was trying to find
other smaller ones. India is a strange one, because India, in terms of growth, it has growth, but it's come from a very small position. So it's at the moment, digital ad spending in India is only around 1 billion, 1.5.
I think it's a bit of a sleeping giant.
It is, yeah. I think it's growing. It's one of the biggest digital ad spend growers, but it has come from a smaller place. So it's 26% growth year on year in terms of digital ad spend. Around a billion.
Well, thank you for those insights on worldwide ad spend, Craig. via eMarketer,
yes.
I think we should say.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry, that is by
that isn't via Craig's own data insight.
I have not surveys on it myself.
No.
That
is correct.
Okay, so I'm here speaking to Gary Kybel, who is in the US today, and he is going to speak to us about some of the key challenges that the US is seeing from a regulatory perspective. In particular, we're going to cover off one really huge topic that is sort of dominating the data privacy from an online perspective in the US. But before we come onto those topics, hi, Gary, I'm just going to ask you if you could just sort of introduce yourself and give our listeners a little bit of a background as to kind of who you are and what your background is specifically around affiliate marketing.
Sure thing. And thanks for having me, Kevin. So again, my name is Gary Kybel. I'm an attorney with a law firm in New York City called Davis & Gilbert. And Davis & Gilbert is a full-service law firm and practicing primarily in the marketing and communications and media industries. I personally do a lot of work in digital media, privacy, data security, and affiliate marketing falls within that world as well. I've been involved in the affiliate marketing industry for a long time as an old-timer, going back probably to the early 2000s. And I have seen a lot of developments in this space and have continued to work with networks and affiliates and publishers. I also represent the PMA. And so I'm very involved in these issues, and the California privacy law is impacting not just the affiliate marketing space, but all sorts of online businesses in terms of how they deal with information.
Great. Thanks for that. So, yeah, I mean, you've kind of mentioned the main topic that I would imagine we're probably going to talk about today. So for those people outside of the US who potentially are less familiar with some of the proposals, can you give us a brief appraisal of the new data protection law that's been passed in California?
Sure. So at the end of June, the state of California passed an omnibus privacy law called the California Consumer Privacy Act of 2018. This is probably the first very broad privacy law on the state level in the U.S. that governs specific rights that consumers have to their personal information, such as to access the information, delete the information, control how it's being shared. There has not been a comparable law on that is broadly applied to personal information in all industries previously. Sort of how did we get here? The reason California passed this law is that there was an activist, actually, who was a real estate investor, who had proposed a ballot initiative in California. What that would have done is it would have put on this November's ballot for the election a privacy law. And that law was much, much worse for business. So the state of California quickly negotiated with this person who had sponsored the ballot initiative, and they agreed that if a privacy law was passed by the California legislature by June 28th, I believe it was, that he would then pull the ballot initiative and it would not appear in the November ballot. So the California legislature very quickly, probably in record time, passed this privacy law at the end of June, and it takes effect on January 1st, 2020.
Okay, great. So I suppose from, you know, speaking to you from here in the UK and for our wider European audience, this probably has quite strong echoes of GDPR. How would you make a comparison between the two, between what the California law is proposing and what we currently have with the data regulation in Europe?
True. There have been a lot of parallels that have been drawn, and some have called the California law GDPR light. It does not go as far as the GDPR goes in terms of detail and topics. The GDPR is 99 articles, 173 recitals. It's quite detailed. And beyond just giving individual data subjects the right to control how their data is used, the GDPR goes into great lengths in terms of internal practices and procedures, data security, cross-border data transfers, dealing with regulatory authorities. So there's much more there. California law is mostly focused on the consumer and how that individual can control the use of their data. So it does grant individuals access rights to their personal information, grants them the right to delete their personal information that's being held, gives them some rights of portability to get copies of their data and take it elsewhere. And interestingly, it focuses on the sale of data. When one business sells personal information to another business, there's a requirement to give consumers notice and an opportunity to opt out of such transfers. And then there's many other elements, such as not discriminating against consumers who have opted out of sharing their data, although there are some carve-outs from that requirement. And there are some potential damages and liability. Whereas the GDPR, everyone knows, for the most part, has very broad penalties that can be up to 4% of a company's annual revenue, the California law only has a private right of action, meaning that an individual can sue if there is a security breach of their data. Otherwise, enforcement is through the regulators.
I mean, what you mentioned there a couple of points about some of the distinctions. One of the things when I was doing a little bit of research about this that I was looking into was that they seem to make there's still quite, almost like a qualifying criteria in that it only impacts businesses of a certain size, which seems, which is would be a contrast to GDPR. Is that the case?
Yes, there is language about the type of business that it applies to, and there are thresholds for that, so that it would not apply to every single company, whereas the GDPR would apply to pretty much anyone who's processing personal data. But the California law applies to a company that's doing business in the state of California and has gross revenues in excess of $25 million or processes 50,000 or more records of consumers of personal information, or derives 50% or more of its annual revenues from selling consumers' personal information. So don't get hung up too much on the $25 million revenue threshold, because processing 50,000 consumer records is a standard that even a very small company might trip up on. So, but yes, you're correct, Kevin. There is a threshold there which is different than in GDPR, where there is no comparable threshold.
Yeah, I mean, one of the other things that I was quite interested in, I don't know whether this is something that is deliberate or just a completely different approach to data privacy, but I noticed, obviously, within GDPR, there's a distinction between roles that companies play in dealing with data. So you have the processor and controller role, whereas that's how GDPR has been framed, whereas there doesn't seem to be a similar framing. Is that conceptually not something that is familiar in the US?
I just think it's consistent with the intention of the California law. As we discussed, the California law is really focused on the individual consumer, the individual data subject, and their rights to access and control the use of their information, whereas the GDPR goes into great detail about internal procedures.
Yeah.
And the GDPR has a lot of focus on data controllers and data processors and how they work with one another and what are the requirements for internal data security. This California law just did not get to that internal facing aspect.
Mm. So I suppose trying to drill it down from an affiliate perspective for our audience, there's obviously the qualifying criteria, if you like, based on volume. But how would you place affiliate in context of this? Obviously, there's lots of different affiliate activity out there. So certain affiliate activity is going to be more probably impacted than others. But how are you talking to affiliates or clients within this space about what the potential impact is likely to be?
Well, there's certainly going to be an impact, because let's keep in mind, we've been talking about personal information. But the definition of personal information is extremely broad under the California law. It includes browsing and search history, geolocation data. It includes inferences. It actually says inferences, data that is far beyond what people might think of as personal information. Now, there has already been one amendment to this law, and I suspect that there are going to be many other amendments between now and 2020. One of the amendments that was passed very recently did try to clarify the definition of personal information to say that, you know, for some of these broad areas, it's got to be associated with or could reasonably be linked to a particular consumer or household. So it remains to be seen how that's going to be interpreted. So if you have browsing data on an individual based on a cookie, how closely is that identified with a particular consumer? If it's tied to their, you know, IP address or their MAC address or their ad ID, is that enough to pull it within the realm of personal information? So for affiliate purposes, it's not enough to simply sit back and say, well, I don't have a consumer's name or email address. You know, I'm just doing some targeting and the purchases are made by the merchant through the merchant. I don't collect that information. You know, affiliates may be in possession of data that meets the definition of personal information under this law, which means they're going to need to put in place procedures in order to comply with a consumer's access and other requests.
Okay. And from what we've discovered in the UK and in the wider European Union is there's obviously been a degree of support that we've received. You know, we've received guidance from local regulators. And also there's kind of been this wider digital coalition involving the IAB predominantly, you know, to try and produce both guidance and also practical tools and technology that can be implemented. Is that something that you anticipate also happening in the US to try and kind of help people navigate through the new law?
Yeah, I think there's going to be a lot of activity here. I think that people are still getting over their GDPR hangover and still dealing with that. And of course, that's not going to end anytime soon once enforcement actions start to pick up. But I think, and also we're waiting for guidance from the California Attorney General. They're supposed to enact regulations to explain how this law is going to be enforced and work. So we're waiting on that as well. As I said, I think we might have more amendments coming to the law. So I think there's going to be a lot of activity in 2019 in the industry talking about what this law means and how it's going to be implemented and enforced. And I think then companies then will spend time in 2019 figuring out how to put in place compliance procedures.
And, you know, this law is obviously gaining a lot of headlines because it's, I guess because it's one of the first, and it's obviously California, which is a huge economy within the US. When California passes laws like this, is that seen as a kind of a mark in the sand for all of the other states in the US, and are we likely to see other states falling into line with similar types of legislation?
Yeah, because it's hard in the US to conduct business without doing business in California. And, you know, one of the largest economies in the world. So it often is the case that when California passes a new law, not just in privacy, but in other areas of commerce, that it becomes a de facto national standard. So that is quite often the case. And then other states tend to follow what California does. So I don't think it would be surprising to see some other states come out with similar laws. It's difficult if there are 50 different standards to meet, and hopefully that does not become the case. But I think we could see other states start to pop up with laws such as these.
Yeah, potentially creating quite a bit of a headache for businesses that want to do business across the whole country.
Exactly.
Okay, so I mean that gives us a kind of a really useful sort of potted description of what we can expect to come over the next couple of years. I believe, is it January 2020? We're looking at the final, when the law actually comes actually becomes law.
That's correct. Although the most recent amendment that was passed prohibits the California Attorney General from enforcing the law until 6 months after they issued regulations, or July 1st, 2020, whichever is sooner. So if the California AG does not get regulations out in time, then the enforcement date is going to be pushed back.
Okay. So finally, before you leave us, Gary, I just wanted to ask you, I know that you sort of go out and you present and travel across the country presenting on a variety of different topics and updates from the kind of general regulatory environment. I just wondered whether there's anything else that you've kind of witnessed or heard about or you've been dealing with recently that is kind of more interesting to a wider audience from a regulatory or compliance perspective.
There's a lot of activity on the state level in the area of privacy and data. Some laws are being proposed that are similar to the fact that it would give consumers more rights or require more disclosures or more transparency around data practices. Not many have been signed into law and become effective. One of the few others that has, there's a Vermont law, which becomes effective January 2019, which is requires data brokers to register with the state. And those are companies that have personal information about consumers but do not have a direct relationship with that consumer. So we're watching a lot of activity out there, and you know, we send out alerts occasionally on these issues and post things to our website, but we do want to just stay alert because you never know when a new standard comes down the pipe which is completely alien to the industry and would require a change in practices.
It sounds like all of these different states are kind of keeping you on your toes about what to advise your clients.
I very much appreciate all these state legislatures, you know, passing what might be viewed as the Full Employment Act for lawyers.
Gary, that's really useful. Thanks very much for joining us today. It's been really insightful. So, thanks once again. And if anybody wants to find out anything more about kind of stuff that you're working on, do we go to have you got a website that anyone can access?
Yeah, they should be able to find me on my firm's website, which is dglaw.com. That's DG as in Davis Gilbert, dglaw.com.
Fantastic. Thanks, Gary.
All right. You're welcome.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that's virtually all we have time for this month. Thanks to Gary for joining us this week as our main guest and providing some thoughtful insights there. Before we go, though, it's worth pointing out a few upcoming events and content pieces to look out for in the coming weeks. I'll be speaking at the Awin Fashion and Retail Day in Stockholm on Thursday, the 27th of September, talking about how affiliate marketing can save the internet. So if you're planning to be there, please do pop over and say hi. Not during the talk, obviously, but in the meantime, Kevin will also be speaking on the same day, but in a different country when he attends the Performance Day conference in Warsaw, where I believe you're due to talk about the power of data in performance marketing and how to use customer lifetime value and business intelligence to drive more sales.
It sounds like you want to do it.
That's a long title. Kevin's also just published a piece on ITP 2.0 and how that is likely to affect Awin's tracking, as we discussed earlier. You can find that on the Awin Market Insights Hub right now. And you can also look forward to seeing several pieces published on there from us over the coming weeks as we look forward to Black Friday 2018 and the annual peak trading period that is just around the corner. In fact, our next scheduled podcast episode will also be Black Friday focused, as we plan to have a special edition discussing with a host of experts what they expect to see from the annual sales bonanza this year, as well as from some of the other global shopping dates that occur around it, such as China's Singles Day. Finally, a big thank you to everyone that got behind us in our fundraising efforts for the affiliate industry bike ride to Paris earlier this month. I'm pleased to say that we all survived just about and made it there in 24 hours. And Awin also managed to smash our target and have raised over £12,000 for the mental health charity Mind, not to mention another £13,000 that was raised on behalf of the British Heart Foundation by the rest of the cycling teams that took part in the event. All in all, it was a huge success. So that's it for this month's episode. Thanks for joining us, and please do tune in again next month when we'll have yet another interview and more discussion of all the latest news from across the affiliate and digital advertising industry. It's goodbye from me. It's goodbye from Kev.
Goodbye.
And goodbye from Craig.
Goodbye.